This is the Anderson Files on Podclips. The Anderson Files is a look at commerce, investment, economics, and retirement issues that affect each and every one of you. Your host is Mike Anderson, Executive Vice President and Registered Investment Advisor of the Warner Companies, a Foundation Risk Partners Warburg Pincus company. The Warner Companies is a registered investment advisor with securities offered through M Holdings Security Incorporated, member of FINRA and SIPC. And now your host, friend and colleague, Mike Anderson.
What is a probate proceeding? Why is it bad? How we avoid it? My guest today, I'll be chatting with David Snyder. David is an estate planning and probate attorney in Thousand Oaks, serving all of Southern California and counties throughout the state. For the last 24 years, he has served in excess of 5,000 clients with their planning needs and questions. He crafts plans which account for all possible circumstances without the waste of time and money of court proceedings. David, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I sincerely appreciate an opportunity to speak to your listeners about one of my favorite subjects, estate planning.
Absolutely. What, to start out, what is a probate proceeding?
Well, a probate proceeding is a court supervised proceeding dealing with the administration of the estate of a decedent. Somebody has passed away. They own property, and that property is valued in excess of the statutory minimum. Now, unfortunately, the statutory minimum here in California is exceptionally low, $61,500 for real estate, $184,500 for your other assets. So it's very difficult to find anybody who owns any real estate in the great state of California valued at less than $61,500. So when those people don't have an estate plan, a proper estate plan in place, their estate will pass through a probate proceeding.
And with a probate proceeding, why is it bad? What are the negatives and how individuals, the survivors, end up in these situations?
Well, there's three primary negatives. Number one, it's exceptionally expensive. All the costs in a probate proceeding essentially boil around the gross value of the estate, not the net equity. Now, many of us here in California own million-dollar homes. We have somewhat significant mortgages on them. The probate proceeding doesn't care about the mortgage. It only simply looks at the gross value. And frankly, the most expensive part of the probate proceeding, me, the probate attorney. We get paid a percentage of the gross. It's a statutory commission set forth in the probate code how much these attorneys get paid. On a million-dollar estate, which here in California is simply not a lot of money, it is $23,000. And then $10,000 for every million thereafter. So a simple $2 million estate here, the attorney's fees, $33,000. Add to that, then we have the personal representative's fees. This is the person who's managing the probate estate. They are paid at the exact same compensation level as the attorney. If I took 33, the personal rep takes 33. We've now cost the family $66,000. We haven't even spoken about the fixed costs like filing fees, appraisals, bond, publication. The average family could look at a end bill of $75,000 in a probate proceeding. So that's the number one thing that we're trying to avoid. We're trying to save this family literally tens of thousands of dollars. Number two, they're very lengthy proceedings during which time we do not have the ability to distribute the assets. So if we have children waiting on college tuition, or you were providing help, you know, to supplement your mother's apartment or her stay in the assisted facility, None of those expenditures are coming out of this probate estate. I just filed a matter in Orange County, filed yesterday, got a court hearing date of November 10. That's literally 4 months out before we get to start. So it's a long, long waiting time. Lastly, the third thing is it's a public proceeding. So we have to give notice to all known and unknown creditors. Visa, MasterCard, Shell, Gasoline. Invite them all to come in and make claims against the probate estate. Then we got to find everybody the decedent didn't know or didn't tell us that he owed money. Well, how do we do that? We advertise. And so we're inviting people to make claims. So those are the three primary reasons why we're looking to avoid that process.
David, with the time of a probate proceeding, what kind of, once it starts, what's the range of time that these, that it can take to move to conclusion?
If we had a court with a short calendar and I was able to literally work at what I call warp speed, we can be in and out of a probate proceeding in about 9.5, 10 months. On average, I'm finding that we're closer to anywhere between 16 and 18 months. And I presently have open probate actions in San Diego, Orange, two different courts in Riverside, downtown LA, Ventura County, Mendocino County, and Contra Costa County. All of them are running slow.
Did COVID and the pandemic affect the court calendar or the time of a lot of these proceedings that were in motion or were able to be started during COVID?
Well, like most industries, it did have an effect because courts went dark a lot and added many more dark days to their calendar until they figured out how to essentially put their staff in remote work. Today, you could even argue it might be slightly more efficient as the courts have fully embraced Zoom and some of the courts use Teams to have these meetings. LA Superior Court, as an example, has their own camera service, LA Court Connect. So we have seen some increase in efficiency, but the overall backlog in the courts, just simply the amount of matters that have to be run through the court, is still an ever-increasing number. So avoiding the probate proceeding is really where the family needs to put their time and their investment.
Over the last year or so currently, are you finding that there's an increase in probate petitions that are coming to you and just in general happening within the state?
Certainly at my office there are, and at any given moment, I would typically have about 5 to 6 open probate matters, and now I'm averaging 10 and 11 for the last 18 months.
This is Mike Anderson. I'm host of The Anderson Files, and I'm chatting today with David Snyder, estate planning attorney based in Thousand Oaks.
The Anderson Files is a proud advocate for the Small Business Council of America. For decades, the SBCA has been the voice for U.S. small business on the Hill and to the administration, successfully pursuing favorable tax, benefits, and estate legislation. To learn more and to become a member or sponsor, go to www.sbca.net.
David, to continue, you've coined a phrase, death taxes, and don't have an 18-year-old make decisions. And why is that? Where did that come from?
Well, you know, we often hear the phrase that there are two certainties in life. And those two certainties are death and taxes. And that, you know, is just no way of getting around. If we enter the game, then we're absolutely going to pass away at some point in the future. And yeah, nobody escapes the taxes. But the other thing that I think that has to be added to that is don't let your kid have $1 million. 18-year-olds do not make good decisions. Now, this doesn't mean that they're bad people, but they lack the experience. And I speak with parents every day, helping them develop their estate plans. And they talk about, well, you know, I want to make sure my kid gets the dough. I want to make sure that my kid doesn't have to go through a probate proceeding, that we don't have to pay Dave tens of thousands of dollars in that in wasted time. But the reality is that, again, 18-year-olds don't make good decisions. So typically what we're trying to do is develop a plan within your estate plan that's going to take into consideration that our young children, our young adult children, are going to still need some seasoning. The state of California says you're an adult at 18. You get to vote for president, you can carry an M16 rifle and go die in a foreign land. But that doesn't mean you know how to handle the inheritance. So a typical estate plan that we create is going to have provisions that allows a successor trustee to hold back those assets, provide those assets to that beneficiary as they might be needed for their health, their education, and their welfare. But otherwise, we might choose to distribute it over a period of time, allowing that beneficiary to mature into their inheritance. So that's what I talk about. In addition, of course, your 18-year-old is not ready to run your estate. There's no reason to believe that your 18-year-old son is going to know what to do or how to manage your assets.
You know, one thing that I run into as an investment advisor are individuals that are referred to me and they've inherited some dollars, typically from their parents, and they end up, by the time I'm speaking with them, they're in or just about to enter a probate, and they're kind of left and are at a stage where they don't really know what to do. They don't know why this is happening. They're having to deal with it. There's no other way to deal with it. And they're just kind of grappling along for direction on something that they weren't prepared to deal with. I'm certain you run into this. How do you get these folks on the right track?
Well, yes, I see that. And I see it also, it comes with a share of anger. What the reality is that the probate proceeding has three simple triggers: death, ownership of the asset, and the value. So when that asset is taken out of the decedent's name, so obviously this has to happen prior to passing away. So when the person creates a trust, they take their home and they retitle their home in the name of the trust. They retitle their brokerage account in the name of the trust. They retitle their life insurance in the name of the trust. The trust is a separate legal entity capable of owning property. The trust now owns those assets. All the other factors remain in play. The value is what the value is. People have expiration dates. Fortunately, they're not known, but eventually the person passes away. But what have we done through the trust? We've taken ownership out of that person's name and retitled it into this entity, the Anderson Family Living Trust. The trust owns the asset. Michael Anderson does not. So when Michael Anderson passes away, we still have the same three rules: death, ownership, and value. But when we look at the ownership column, that answer is going to be zero because he's retitled the assets in the name of the trust. The trust says, give these assets, divide them equally amongst my children. And, you know, inside 40 days, we're already distributing assets.
You know, and I've also have seen situations where once I come in contact, again, as an investment advisor with an individual, a couple, a family, and you discover where they've had multiple individuals that have passed away. The parents have passed away. Maybe an aunt or an uncle have passed away and they had dollars, and trying to find the, you know, giving them direction where it's a compounded problem. We're not just talking about one person passing away or a couple, but other family members that have as well. And here they are, the beneficiaries in what might be a very minimal set of wills from parents and aunt and uncle. I can imagine you run into more complex situations.
Yes, yes. The woman passed away. She had only a single heir, no parents, one sibling, no children. Her sister was in a conservatorship, born with developmental disabilities. And so the sister was the sole heir. The decedent had no will. We had to run a probate proceeding, and we had to give $1.3 million to the sister in the conservatorship, who couldn't understand what a single dollar was. There was simply no plan. We finally finished that. We have to establish a new conservator for our disabled person. That takes time. And now our person with those disabilities has recently passed away, and now we have to run the probate proceeding again on the same $1.3 million. Now, it got even worse because the family member who, the family got together and said, yes, we want to have Dennis be the personal representative of the estate. He subsequently passed away before we finished the probate proceeding. So the best way to avoid all this mishigash is to have a proper plan. And you start with working with a professional estate planning attorney who can devise a plan that helps you out. We start by identifying what those assets are, identifying who we would turn to as our trusted friends, our trusted persons to follow up, meaning if I'm going to be the trustee of my trust, my wife and I, but if we pass away or we become incapacitated, who will these responsibilities fall to? Will they fall to my daughter? Will they fall to my brother, my best friend? We're looking for those persons that we have faith and confidence in. Come hell or high water, these people have our back. Making both financial and property decisions as well as healthcare decisions. Our third area is to determine how to distribute those assets. Are we going to distribute it to our children? Is it going to the children equally? Or did we give my other daughter $200,000 to purchase her first home, so we need to provide some offset in the trust for the daughter I didn't give the money to? Do we have any special needs issues? Unfortunately, what we see is many families grappling with the problems of developmental disabilities, that a child might be autistic, as an example, and can't inherit. So you're looking for a professional who is skilled in these areas to lay out a plan. It is physically impossible, Mike, physically impossible for you to know what you don't know. If you don't know the right questions to ask, how could you possibly get the right answers? So when you work with a skilled professional who is not simply looking to find the most expedient way to draft some documents, but is asking you the questions, some of the questions that perhaps you never thought of or are sometimes even uncomfortable to think about, then you're getting the proper input, and we can draft a customized plan that will fit all of those needs. And not just those needs in what happens when I die, but what happens if the person we've designated as our successor trustee, what if they're unable, unwilling to act? What's our backup plan to that? In fact, I often tell clients, I prepare 150 odd pages of nothing but backup plan. It's entirely a backup plan, right?
David, you wrote a recent article on the estate planning subject. Has that been published? What was that article pertaining to?
Yes. I wrote an article, The Three Biggest Mistakes in Estate Planning, and it was recently published in Echelon Professional Magazine. It's a quarterly magazine here in the Southern California region. It's available through the Echelon website, www.echelonbiz.com. It's also available in some of the local newsstands. Funny enough, I saw it when I was out eating lunch one afternoon. And, oh, there's the magazine that I contributed to. And it is a focus on the three biggest problems that I come to see. And in no particular order, just to go over it, the three biggest problems. Number one, funding the trust. You've created the trust, but for whatever reason, all of the assets were not titled in the name of the trust. And I've heard every story under the sun from inadvertence, forgetfulness to, I didn't think I had to do that. It's very, very simple in my world. The trust either owns the asset or it doesn't. So creating a trust, step one, funding it, retitling the assets is step two. Problem number two is choice of the trustees, the successor trustees. There's a huge default here. Eldest child, eldest male child. I don't know. We're not in old feudal England anymore. I don't know why that still comes up. But this idea that, well, Michael is the oldest, so Michael should be the trustee. The family should look to those persons that they have faith and confidence in. The best person to do this job. I love my three daughters dearly. I love them equally. My youngest daughter has the greatest skill set when it comes to the types of functions that a successor trustee is going to need. It has nothing to do with the other two kids. She has that skill set. So you have to choose the right people. The third issue that I see that comes up is, again, when to distribute. You don't want to give too much too soon. Typically, we're going to look at an adult beneficiary and figure that between roughly the ages of 18 and 30, they're not seasoned yet. They haven't reached their full level of maturity yet. And throwing money at a youngster, a young adult, is simply not a cure. It's really creating more problems.
David, what is the best way for our listeners to reach you?
Oh, thank you for that question. I love that one. Your listeners can reach me directly by phone, 805-374-8777. They're also welcome to shoot me email. You can email me directly at dschneider, so that's dschneider, at drs-law.com. And it's not doctors, it's those are my initials. So dschneider at drs-law.com. You can also go to my website and find a ton of information, including past blogs that we've put out on these services, www.drs-law.com.
David, thanks so much for guesting today, and we look forward to having you back in the future.
Michael, thank you so much for the opportunity. Loved it. Great questions. I hope that your listeners get some useful kernels out of that.
I'm certain they will. I'm certain they will. Thank you, Daryl Wayne, engineer, Mark Allen, producer. I'm Mike Anderson, and this is The Anderson Files on podclips.io. Keep calm and keep listening.
You've been listening to The Anderson Files with Mike Anderson. Visit us at podclips.io and check on the financial channel for more episodes and information on The Anderson Files.